A data-driven exploration proving that Lightning scales Bitcoin payments beyond Visa and that second layer innovation is the way. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I wanted to do, I started kind of writing out all of my thoughts on the episode I had talked about on blockchains searching for a problem, blockchain solutions searching for a problem, and trying to make sense of all of the supposed use cases of blockchains and tokens with voting and supply chains and NFT concert tickets and all of this stuff. And I was kind of getting a lot of my notes together and things, and I just realized it's going to take me a little bit longer than I had hoped, so I won't be able to get it out today. So I decided to pause, and I want to do a really quick read on the Lightning Network, and I'm going to try to have the guys take out tomorrow. But this one was a really good one that's not super long or anything, but I thought was a really good data-oriented approach to the Lightning Network and how things are going right now. It's by Stanislav Kozlovsky. Hopefully I said that right. First-time author on the show. It's posted on Bitcoin Magazine. I'll have the link in the show notes so that you can check him out. But really quick, before we jump into the article, I want to thank our sponsors, and then we'll get right into it. If you're trying to get Bitcoin, just go to Swan Bitcoin. You need a place to learn, you need a place to buy, you need a place to set up a savings account, you need a place to figure out how to connect your business, your 401k, you want to see market analysis, all of it. Just go to Swan Bitcoin. Then you get yourself a Fold debit card. It's going to get you sats back on everything in life because everybody is still having to use fiat from time to time. Make sure you're getting paid sats to do that. And lastly, you're going to want to keep all of those sats safe with a cold card. The cold card Mark IV, super secure, air-gapped hardware wallet that is one of the longest running, if not the longest, in the space. Plus tons of other great Bitcoin hardware security solutions to check out at CoinKite. Check out the link right there in the show notes. With that, let's jump into today's article from Bitcoin Magazine, and it's titled, Data Shows That Bitcoin's Lightning Network Has Solved the Scalability Problem. A data-driven exploration proving that Lightning scales Bitcoin payments beyond Visa and that second-layer innovation is the way. By Stanislav Kozlovsky. This is an opinion editorial by Stanislav Kozlovsky, a software engineer and macroeconomic researcher. Many Bitcoiners have heard of Bitcoin's, quote, lack of scalability. It is one of the most common critiques waged against the project by both gluttonous cryptocurrency competitors and incumbent establishment actors. Some old-timers may remember the heated, bathed-in-controversy block-size wars of 2015 to 2017, which, aided by industry insiders, most shallowly aimed to make Bitcoin scale to more transactions by increasing the maximum block size, and by doing so, almost set precedent and changed Bitcoin's future course forever. Both of these issues will ultimately prove to be left on the wrong side of history. In this piece, we are going to show how the Lightning Network addresses Bitcoin's scalability problems and undoubtedly proves that the small block decision was ultimately the right one. Base layer limitations and choices. Before we understand what the Lightning Network is solving, we should first understand what the inherent problem is. Simply put, you cannot scale a blockchain to validate the entire world's transactions in a decentralized way. The scalability trilemma. Scalability, decentralization, and security. Pick two. Blockchains suffer from an inherent limitation which forces them to trade off between three qualities: One quality of their system has to go for the other two. As pictured above, a blockchain can only reliably have two of these three qualities. Decentralized, not controlled by any single party or a small number of elites. Scalable, scaled to a sufficient number of transactions. Secure, not be easy to attack and break its invariance. It is worth noting that all of these characteristics sit on separate complex spectrums. For example, you don't become secure over a certain threshold. It is very dependent on the use case and many different characteristics. Bitcoin is slow for a reason. It explicitly picked to optimize the security and decentralization sections of the trilemma, leaving scalability, transactions per second, on the sideline. The key realization is that, much like today's internet and financial system, it is more optimal to comprise the whole system of separate layers, where each layer optimizes for and is used for different things. Bitcoin, the base layer, is a globally replicated public ledger. Every transaction is broadcast to every participant in the network. It is evident that one cannot practically scale such a ledger to accommodate the entire world's growing transaction rate. Apart from being impractical and privacy damaging, its drawbacks vastly outweigh its insignificant benefits. Back in the day, there was a major civil war between the online community on what Bitcoin should do to increase its transaction throughput capacity. There is major infuriating controversy in this story, and is in large part what shaped Bitcoin to remain what it is today, a grassroots, bottom-up movement where the average people, plebs, in aggregate with one another, dictate the rules of the network. The Block Size War, by Jonathan Beer, illustrates the battle between the decentralized network supporters wanting what's best for the long-term viability of the network and the greed and propaganda perpetrated by major players and corporations to further their own power-gaining and profit-seeking agendas. Long story short, Bitcoin was forked into a failed fork named Bitcoin Cash. The little guy eventually won. Bitcoin did not rush any bad design choices that would come to compromise its decentralization, security, or censorship resistance. The decision was effectively made to scale Bitcoin through layers, introducing second layers that work separately from Bitcoin and checkpoint their state to the main, slower but more secure network. In stark contrast, the evidently unsuccessful fork Bitcoin Cash sacrificed all hopes of decentralization by increasing its block size to 32 megabytes, 32 times more than Bitcoin, for a mere maximum of 50 payments per second on the base chain. Block size. Each Bitcoin block has a cap on its size, and this denotes the upper bound on how many transactions can exist inside of a block. If demand grows to outpace the amount of transactions a block can have, the block becomes full and transactions get left unconfirmed in the mempool. Users begin to outbid each other via the adjustable transaction fee in order to have their transaction be included by the miners, who are incentivized to choose the highest paying transactions. A naive solution to this would be to simply increase the block size limit, that is, allow more transactions to be included in a block. The negative side effects of this are subtle enough that even intellectuals like Elon Musk make the mistake of suggesting it. Increasing the block size has second-order effects which decrease the decentralization of the network. As the block size grows, the cost to run a node in the network increases. In Bitcoin, each node has to store and validate each transaction. Further, said transaction has to be propagated to the node's peers, which multiplies the network's bandwidth requirements for supporting more transactions. The more transactions, the more the network's processing, CPU, and storage, disk, requirements grow for each node. Because running a node yields no financial benefits, the incentive to run one disproportionately decreases the more costly it is. To put it into numbers, if Bitcoin is to ever scale to Visa's purported peak capacity levels, 24,000 transactions per second, a node would need 48 megabits per second just to receive the transactions over the network. The following is a map showing the average internet speed in the world. As you can see, a massive part of the world's average speed would exclude them from the ability to run a node under these conditions. Note that average speed implies that many are even lower than said threshold. Additionally, it doesn't account for the fact that a user would have other uses for their bandwidth. Few selfless people would dedicate 50% of their internet bandwidth for a Bitcoin node. More importantly, the amount of data this would generate would make it impossible for anyone to practically store it. It would result in 518 gigabytes of data per day, or 190 terabytes of data every year. Further, spinning up a new node would require one to download all of these petabytes of data and verify each signature, both of which would make it so that a new node would take a long time, years, to spin up. And to make matters worse, 24,000 transactions per second doesn't make for a truly unique global payments network in and of itself. Visa isn't the only payments network in the world, and the world is growing more interconnected every day. Lightning Network 101. The Lightning Network is a separate second-layer network that works on top of the main Bitcoin network. Simply said, it batches Bitcoin transactions. To access it, you need to run your own node or use somebody else's. The network has two concepts worth understanding for the purposes here. A Lightning Node, separate software that communicates with each other and constitutes a new peer-to-peer network. Channels, a connection opened between two Lightning Nodes, allowing for payments to flow between them. A channel is literally a Bitcoin base layer transaction, anchoring the channel to the secure chain. Once two nodes open a channel between one another, payments start flowing between them. Each subsequent payment modifies the channel's state, cryptographically revoking the old one and checkpointing the new one in memory and on disk of both nodes, but critically, not to the base chain. Channels can, and in my opinion, ideally should, stay open for a long time, for example, a year or more. If the nodes ever decide to close down their channel, their latest balance after all the off-chain payments is restored to their original wallets. This is cryptographically secured by hashed time lock contracts, or HTLC, and digital signatures, which we won't get into detail for the purposes of this article. This allows one to batch billions of payments into two on-chain transactions, one for opening the channel and one for closing it. Once a payment is complete, it is indisputable what the latest balance is between all parties, assuming nodes redundantly store their channel checkpoints. Critically, one need not be directly connected to another party in order to pay them. Channels can be used by other nodes in the network in order to increase their reachability. In other words, if Alice is connected to Bob and Bob is connected to Carolyn, Alice and Carolyn can seamlessly pay each other through Bob. Lightning scalability. As we will now prove, the Lightning Network already scales to support 16,264 transactions a second today, and therefore solves the scalability problem while preserving all the benefits Bitcoin has to offer: permissionlessness, scarcity, user sovereignty, portability, verifiability, decentralization, and censorship resistance. For a payment to make its way through the network, it typically has to go through multiple payment channels. To answer how many payments the network can do in a second, we need to understand how many an average channel supports. Statistics show that the average payment goes through around three channels. The benchmark numbers we will use for this analysis have per node throughput capacity, not per channel. Therefore, we will inaccurately assume that each node has just one channel. The default LND node is said to be able to do 33 payments per second with a decent machine, 8 virtual CPUs, and 32 gigabytes of memory, according to the benchmark. With 16,266 nodes in the network as of November 2022, assuming each payment has to go through three channels or four nodes, the network should be able to achieve around 134,194 payments per second. That is, each payment has to go through a group of four nodes, and there are 4,066 such unique groups in the network. Assuming each node can do 33 payments a second, we multiply 4,066 by 33 to reach 134,194. Now, to be realistic, not every node is running a machine like the one in the benchmark. Many are simply running on a Raspberry Pi. Thankfully, it doesn't take much to be able to beat the current payment systems. Lightning versus traditional payments. Finding authentic numbers about the peak capacity of traditional payment systems is hard, so we will rely on their average payment rate throughout the 2021 financial year. We will compare that to the theoretical capacity of Lightning, because conversely, getting the average rate of payments in Lightning is impossible due to its private nature, and is also not revealing of capability because the demand for Lightning payments is still relatively low. This comparison will give us an idea of how many payments a Lightning node needs to be capable of routing in order to outcompete traditional finance. Visa saw 165 billion payments in 2021. PayPal saw 19.3 billion payments across its whole platform, and Fedwire saw 204 million. Respectively, these amount to 7,372, 612, and 6.5 payments per second on average for 2021. To put into perspective, Bitcoin did 2.44 payments per second in 2021 and scales up to a maximum of 7 per second. The numbers are promising. It takes each Lightning node to be capable of doing just 4 payments a second in order to beat the current payment networks by at least 2 times. At that rate, 4,066 unique 4-node groups can achieve 16,264 payments per second, or 2.2 times that of the largest competitor, Visa. To make matters worse for traditional payments networks, the average Lightning transaction fee is 13 times less than that of Visa, 0.1% compared to 1.29%. It's worth remembering that one could always continue to scale the Lightning network by creating new nodes. Since it is peer-to-peer, its scalability is theoretically unlimited as long as nodes in the network grow. Further, the aforementioned benchmark by BottlePay makes the case that there are no real technical blockers for Lightning node implementations to eventually reach 1,000 payments per second. At such a number, the network's current throughput would be closer to 4 million per second, not to mention what it would be with an increase in the number of nodes. And lastly, it is worth remembering that the Lightning network is still very much immature software and has a fair amount of future optimizations to be done, both in the protocol and its implementations. Resources, in terms of developers, are the only short-term constraint to increasing scalability, which has rightfully come second to more important matters like reliability. To give a sense of the progress there, River Financial recently shared that its payment success rate is 98.7% at an average size of $46, which is astonishingly better than the earliest publicly available data it could find from 2018, where $5 transactions were failing 48% of the time. Conclusion. In this piece, we exposed all of the negative drawbacks of scaling the Bitcoin blockchain through increasing the base layer's block size, most notably severely compromising its decentralization, and ultimately failing to achieve its aim of reaching the immense scalability needed for the demands a global payments network has and will continue to increasingly have in the future. We showed that the Lightning network, as a second layer solution, most elegantly solves the scalability problem by both preserving all of Bitcoin's benefits while at the same time scaling it way beyond what any base layer solution promises. All right, so that wraps up the article by Stanislav Kozlovsky Again, at Bitcoin Magazine is a opinion piece. So it, you know, disclaimer: opinions expressed are entirely their own, do not necessarily reflect those of BTC Incorporated or Bitcoin Magazine. So let's hit our sponsor really quick, and then we will jump back in because I got a little bit to say about this article. If you're trying to get into Bitcoin, the last thing you want to you don't want to get lost in the noise. You don't want to get lost in crypto and shitcoins. You don't want to go to one of the casinos that are going to try to push the next token onto you so that they can offload it. You just want to go to Swan Bitcoin. Stay away from everything else. It doesn't even matter what you do after. Just if you are onboarding into Bitcoin, you want to learn about it. You want to check it out. You want to start buying some, you want a savings account, you want to get your business connected, you want the concierge service with Swan Private, and you want to get access to their team, you want to be able to ask them questions. They do Twitter spaces constantly. They have an incredible database of curated content, my stuff included up there. I have a curated rabbit hole to explain what Bitcoin is. And every other topic that you can think about Bitcoin, they've got it. They've got incredible market analysis. I read their newsletter and their blog religiously. They are literally the best source I know to go and get directed and know what you're getting yourself into, know how to keep it safe, and that they will teach you all of the rules to make sure that when things like this happen with like the FTX blow up, with BlockFi and Three Arrows Capital, all of these companies and exchanges that are just falling apart, they will teach you all of the things so that you do not get lost in that jungle of nonsense. If you had just gone to Swan, you never would have gone over there. You never would have had any of those problems. That is why I recommend it and have done so for a very, very long time and why I use it myself. Check out Swan Bitcoin. I have a personal link as well, which is my affiliate. It's swanbitcoin.com/guy. Check it out. The link is right there in the show notes. All right. So I don't have a lot of time on this one, but there's a couple of really cool things. First, I really love the data-oriented approach here because one of the things that I see a lot is, you know, something that works, you don't have to exaggerate. And I see that, like, there's this meme or, like, a GIF or whatever comparing transactions per second to the various like, payment systems like Visa and then Ethereum and, you know, BSV or whatever. And then, say, Bitcoin on Lightning. And I think the GIF itself, and I still see it published around as, like, a million transactions per second. And it's like, this is like some, you know, way far out theoretical could be there one day. But we're so far from reaching that that it just feels absurd to, like Lightning Network works insanely well. There is no reason to exaggerate its capacity when its capacity is actually phenomenal in the context of has it been able to scale Bitcoin? And I think the best example to show in this context is the fact that it is literally a payments network that can be comparable to Visa. Whether or not it is higher than Visa's average transactions per second or lower, it doesn't matter. Now we are in the space where Lightning's capacity and the scalability of Bitcoin and Lightning as a stack, as a protocol stack, its payment possibilities are in the realm of Visa. And it does not take much to have iterative improvements of, you know, another 5%, another 10% improvement. And one of the things that I think is going to be a massive improvement that has not gotten, that has had essentially no adoption yet. I know there's multiple teams working on it to get it to be seamless and really easy to implement, but splicing, the ability to basically move on in and out of a channel as far as funds go without actually closing the channel so that you can basically alter the amount of funds that are available in the channel on the fly. So rather than opening and closing a channel like this article talked about is to change the channel capacity or open up a different channel with somebody, et cetera, instead of doing both transactions every single time, you can open it And then what you're essentially doing with splicing is in a single transaction, rather than you close it and then open a new one immediately in its place. And that's going to be a huge, huge shift in just kind of the usability. I think it will actually pair well with be very comparable to how things changed in the user interface or the user experience when zero-conf channels became the norm, where basically the channel partner or the LSP that you're using, like let's say for the wallets that I use that do this, you have Moon, M-U-U-N, you have Breeze, you have Phoenix. Phoenix has increasingly become my favorite one that has like a privacy trade-off, whereas Breeze is the most non-custodial. Breeze, the service, doesn't know anything about your payments or anything any more than a traditional node would, outside of the fact that they will open channels on the fly with you. But it, again, in doing so, like, is that the setup of these zero-conf channels essentially made it so that the onboarding process onto Lightning was essentially instant, that you could just receive a payment and then you might not realize it, but a channel just opened online and it happened. It's just happening in the background and your wallet shows that you have a balance even if the channel is not confirmed yet. So it feels like there's no barrier. And I think splicing is going to be a big deal with that too for a couple of different reasons. One is because if you're having to watch like 10 different channels, which can happen, like Breeze is actually a good example. I think there will be a prime candidate for using splicing when it becomes ubiquitous. Is that I think I have like 8 or 9 channels on my mobile wallet. If you actually, you can't really see them, like you have to go into the advanced and you have to say list channels and you can look at them. And I do from time to time, but normally you would know. But your phone, your device, has to do more work if it's checking more channels for essentially paths out, for attempts at making a payment, and it's more likely to use more RAM and take longer to finally find a route in order to make the payment go through. However, doesn't often take very long at all, but it could get out of hand, and it also, I spent a lot of money on my phone to get the most obnoxious one with, you know, all the bells and whistles because I use it as a camera, and my new son, I just knew that I needed the fanciest one because I wasn't going to go get a DSLR camera or have a Canon and like my proper lens in the right spot. I knew that every single time I took pictures or video of Rad, it was going to be with my phone. So I was like, screw it, just give me the one with all the cameras on it. And I don't regret it either. It's amazing what you can actually do with all the cameras on this thing for a freaking smartphone. But that was completely beside the point. So the idea is that I have a pretty powerful phone when it comes to your phone options. So, and not everybody does. You know, there are people still running around here with iPhone 7s, and they need to work as well. But with splicing, the beauty of splicing is that rather than constantly opening new channels when you're receiving payments that you don't have capacity for or that the payment won't go through, and you want to make it so that the user doesn't even know that that's the case, and so they automatically, on the fly, open a new channel. So you don't ever have payments not go through, you just have variable fees because the fee is larger when you're opening up a channel. But if you can splice, you can do this all with one channel. And then there's a whole lot less load on your client and your mobile wallet if it's just pinging out of one channel seeking a path. And that splicing can constantly be used to take capacity out, add capacity back in, and it also gives you the option of more granular management in that way as well, where particularly if there's like an autopilot or if there's an LSP where you can easily batch the opening or the modification of capacity in certain channels. But anyway, that's just a kind of a long roundabout way of saying there's a lot of really cool things that are coming to Lightning. And splicing is just one of many, many examples. And think about how much that iteration, those small improvements will fundamentally change the operation of the network and then add new capacity. But even better is that new capacity increases the likelihood that all of the payments are going to work. This was something that stood out to me when the Lightning Network was originally growing, and it's also something that stands out to me in the context of Keet and Synonym and the peer-to-peer network being built on Hypercore, is that it has the same characteristics, that as it scales, it gets better. The major, obviously it still has scaling issues. It still has infrastructure concerns and reliability concerns. And it's not simply as if, it scales and there's less problems. But when it scales, the core problems are actually improving. Like with Keet and Synonym and slash tags and the Hypercore protocol, it's just like BitTorrent. The more people who are downloading the file, the more responsive and the better the connectivity and the bandwidth is for that file. So just like in file sharing, when you have 1,000 seeders, it's that much better than when you have 2 seeders. Well, the same goes for Keet and Synonym and what they're building. And then the exact same thing goes for Lightning. As we add more nodes, as we add more capacity, there's that many more options there's that many more routes and potential ways to fulfill a payment. And then you have AMPs, which are increasingly becoming common and kind of a standard in a lot of these wallets, which is just multi-path payments where the analogy I like to use is you have like a big cargo ship that needs to go down a river, but the river's too small. But the river splits off into like 4 or 5 different rivers and then comes back together at the other end before, going back out to the other ocean or to a sea or whatever. Well, what if you could break that cargo ship up into 5 smaller ships, go down all of those individual routes, and then come back together and reform into the cargo ship at the other end? That's what you can actually do with Lightning payments, is you take multiple paths to the network. Like if I'm trying to send $1,000 and I've got 5 different paths that let me send $250 a piece is the max capacity. Well, then I just split it up across all 5 of those channels and my payment gets to where it's going. And I have no idea. I just broke it up and sent multiple payments in multiple different directions and they're all combined back together at the other end. And in the philosophy, so to speak, the engineering challenge of scaling. It's funny how when you go back to the block size war, which by the way, I highly, highly recommend getting the block size war and or listening to the audiobook, which I am very happy to have done myself. So if you do want to listen to that audiobook, it is phenomenal. The audiobook is phenomenal, if I do say so myself. No, the book is amazing, and I highly, highly recommend it. It should honestly be required. If there was a course of Bitcoin, or if there was a can you do these handful of simple tasks to get into Bitcoin test, well, the proficiency test would absolutely have to come with you have to listen to and or read The Block Size War, in my opinion. I think it's one of the most important things that ever happened in Bitcoin and one of the most important demonstrations of how Bitcoin works as well. Both the game theory and the economic struggles, so to speak, the economic dynamic between node runners acting in self-defense, validating their own nodes, or validating with their own nodes and their own Bitcoin and their keys, and then essentially the Bitcoin ecosystem, the business and the retail ecosystem and the miners. It's essentially what are the game theory outcomes when one party is trying to change Bitcoin, and what are the dynamics of that conflict? That I thought the block size war was one of the most epic things that happened in Bitcoin because of how it demonstrated the theory of the Bitcoin game theory and the struggle between the different parties, the different subgroups, so to speak, in the Bitcoin ecosystem. But going back to that era and the claim of trying to do this on chain and just how bad of an idea that is, It's funny that there's actually a really great quote in this article. I wrote an article way back when on the scaling problems. What was it? Something about, let me find it real quick. Ah, okay. Seven misunderstandings of Bitcoin's scaling problem. And one of the things I did, one of the things that I laid out and was like a huge like eye opener for me as I was kind of going through this era and trying to make sense of everything that was happening in the space and the arguments at the time is something that Kozlowski did a pretty good job of hitting in this, just this simple quote. It says, and this is in contrast to Visa and in contrast to how much Lightning can scale versus a block size increase. So, quote, in stark contrast, the evidently unsuccessful fork Bitcoin Cash sacrificed all hopes of decentralization by increasing its block size to 32 megabytes, 32 times more than Bitcoin, for a mere maximum of 50 payments per second on the base chain. Now, Bitcoin Cash's blockchain is not nearly as large as Bitcoin, but it is merely because nobody uses the space. So because there are no transactions on Bitcoin Cash, they don't have a bloat problem because they're just not using, they have no demand for 32 megabytes. In fact, they never even filled up 8 when they hard forked to that. And then they hard forked again to 32. But the Bitcoin blockchain is about, it's a little bit more, but it's about 500 gigabytes worth of data right now. Imagine if Bitcoin Cash had actually filled those blocks and had been doing that for the same amount of time that Bitcoin had. And they had a 16 terabyte blockchain. That's the end of personal validation. The only way that you can, the only quote unquote validation that you can do is trusting the rest of the network. And how, have you ever tried to download 16 terabytes of data? And this is something that I talk about a lot too in when we would go over the block size stuff, which I just haven't done in a long time. But that one of the most important things for decentralization is what happens when things go wrong. What happens when you actually lose 30%, 50% of the nodes on the network? Like you have a critical problem and you have to recover from a disaster. How long does it take to download 16 terabytes of data? How long does it take to then do the computational work to validate all of the signatures and all of the hashes and all of the blocks of that same amount of data? If you lost 50% of the nodes on a network that had 16 terabytes and a constant stream of gigabytes of new data coming in, you just lose them. They just never come back. And essentially, you will get in, and it won't take that long. You know, you extrapolate this out five years, 10 years, you've got a network that's got barely a couple of nodes and nobody wants to run it. I mean, you're looking at 50 terabytes, 100 terabytes, and this is a big consequence. This is a huge, huge trade-off for what? 50 payments per second on the base chain? It doesn't compete with anything. The supposed benefit is so unbelievably negligible in the scope of the problem that's trying to be solved that literally any loss of decentralization and security is not worth it. And just the hard fork itself, the splitting of the network into a completely new set of consensus rules, and the dangers that one action has on top of the fact that you are re-centralizing the network out the gate by forcing everybody onto a single client by a single dev group that has not been verified, that you do not know the old consensus rules can tell you nothing reliable and validate nothing meaningful about the new fork. And it doesn't matter if it's 99.9% the same, because the consensus rules don't line up. They're just completely different. So both the act and the client that has to be shifted to is a huge centralizing force, but then you've also set the precedent of just arbitrarily changing the consensus rules. When you fork, you have to go back to social consensus. You lose the primary benefit, the literally revolutionary thing that Bitcoin provides is consensus. It is consensus that is not political and that is not social, that is a technological, that is a fundamental consensus based on a set of validation rules that anybody can run. You're throwing it out the window and saying we're going to temporarily social consensus to find to make changes to this protocol. And what are you doing it for? To get 50 transactions per second. You only have to do that like 100 more times to get even close to Visa. And the analogy I used too in the 7 misunderstandings of the scaling problem is that we're also not, it's important that we can get to Visa now. It's important that the Lightning Network has the capacity to handle that amount of payments or a comparable amount of payments, because the goal or the eventual need is so many orders of magnitude greater that if we don't have a solution that could potentially get us there, or maybe a better way to put it, if we don't have a 100x to 200x solution, then it's not even beginning to chip away at the ultimate problem. A doubling, a 50% increase in transaction capacity is so painfully, uselessly inadequate that it's not even relevant to the discussion. And the problem isn't that we're trying to match Visa. The issue is that we are trying to deal with the fact that there is going to be a global, decentralized, machine-to-machine micropayment system. As we get new technology and as we open up new avenues and get more capacity for making these sorts of payments and doing so securely and very seamlessly across multiple instances and businesses and services and across all the borders in the world, the demands and the means of using that capacity are going to just increase. It's Jevons' paradox, is that, or Jevons, I don't remember exactly how to say his name. Jevons' paradox is that when you make your technology or your system or whatever more efficient, all it does is increase the demand for the use of that technology. So as we get more and more capacity, as it becomes more reliable to make smaller payments and we get more and more capacity and reliably can do 10,000 transactions, 20,000 transactions per second, all it's going to do is open up another use case for an additional 50,000 transactions per second, an additional 100,000 transactions per second. And suddenly we're going to have failed to scale again. Like, we're going to constantly be basically bumping up against this wall, just like smashing into this wall of reaching its limits, its economic limits of doing it. And then we will start to price out some use case, and that demand will essentially be what fuels and funds the shift in the technological development and the new capacity increases and new ways of using all of these tools to get to that next iteration that, you know, fundamentally changes. And I think we're still going to see in the next 20 years, we'll probably see another significant advancement, very infrequently, you know, maybe every 7 years or something, but an advancement that truly changes the game again, just like Lightning did. And honestly, just like I think, I mean, we're not there yet, so I don't want to, you know, call the race won before the race is really, as the race has just barely gotten started. But with the Keats synonym stuff, the stuff that I've been geeking out on lately, and the new peer-to-peer architecture, the fact that it fundamentally changes the client-server model and it breathes new life into BitTorrent, and we have this example of BitTorrent, basically, I mean, BitTorrent was once the highest bandwidth network on the internet. Like, there was the client-server model, and people still think of, like, the internet, the open internet, as, like, oh, it was the internet. You know, internet was Google, and the internet was, Facebook, and, like, all of these things. But there was a time where, even though it wasn't really talked about, I mean, obviously it was talked about, but people didn't think about it like the internet. But there was a time where BitTorrent, the file sharing network, transferred more bandwidth than the open internet. In fact, I read an article not too long ago on torrentfreak.com, just because I like to stay up to date on BitTorrent stuff, because it's been interesting the eras that some of these protocols have gone through, and I like to geek out on it. But it is still the king of upstream data. on the network that, but honestly, the specifics of all this is kind of irrelevant. It's just an interesting thing. But what it indicates, I think, is how successful a peer-to-peer network can be, and that even with the complications and the annoyances and the odd interactions, the way BitTorrent was actually not optimal for a seamless user experience. Like, it requires many different steps, and all the files and things are static. It worked. It worked. In fact, there was even for a time, I wonder if it's probably still around, but there was a popcorn time, which literally you would connect two torrents live on the network and you could watch any movie live. But that was, I think that's an indication of how successful that protocol and that concept of a peer-to-peer network, the architecture of the peer-to-peer network can be. And the fact that that is essentially what HyperCore is. It's BitTorrent except live. And it alters that client-server relationship and makes it a peer-to-peer. Everyone is just a node. And you can be feeding data to other people as easily as you can be consuming data. It changes the dynamic, whereas the current client-server relationship is everybody, all the users are just users, and you have to have, you know, special networking equipment, and you have to, you know your technicals to be able to upload things. You have to port forward and stuff on your router. And then obviously your individual home internet connection isn't going to be able to let, you know, 100,000 people can't come to your website and look at stuff. Like, that's ridiculous. But with BitTorrent, you were able to participate in that way. You could upload a movie file or an image or a song or something like that and distribute it to 100,000 people. In fact, as more and more people downloaded it, it got better. It got easier to distribute it, and it got less load on the seeders that were left in the network. And the fact that you can leverage that to make a live internet is just fascinating to me. And this is actually going to be powered by Lightning. This is one of those things where, as something like that grows out, I think Lightning is going to be absolutely integral to its success, because it will allow the monetization of that infrastructure. Whereas BitTorrent ran entirely on voluntary interactions and voluntary computers. This is actually a monetizable internet, and you can attach public keys and you can attach hashes and payments to the blocks of data so that you could directly and immediately monetize it. But what do you need? You need a payments network with the capacity to basically handle all of these interactions. And it will enable use cases that you can't do on the normal internet, that you can't do in a client-server relationship, but that you can in this new setup, in this new architecture. And that is where I think we're going to see in the next couple of years, we're going to see something trigger. And I've been saying this for a while, and this is the most interesting thing. Like, I've been saying that, like, I think something is going to catch at some point and is going to start gaining steam. And honestly, this is where I think I can see the one that could do it. And it's just so, so exciting to see. And I can't even believe that Paolo Arduino, who is head of Bitfinex and also the chief strategy officer with Hole Punch and Keat, he was saying they have like 100,000 downloads, I believe. I want to make sure that I'm not confusing this with a different, because I just listened to an episode on it recently, which I had no idea. And that's crazy, because like the Keat enthusiast room or whatever just got like 160 people in it. But it's kind of nuts to think that there could be that many people with all over the place on this network that, you know, have all their own rooms and all their own connections and stuff, and that you just like really can't see it. Like, you can't, there's just no central server. All they can do is go by the fact that this is how many people downloaded it from us. But anyway, that was a long tangent away from here. There's another great point that he made, just kind of on the scaling debate, is that in Bitcoin, each node has to store and validate each transaction. And just so you know, I go over this in my Lightning course. My Lightning workshop is, this is the difference between a broadcast and a unicast network. Going back to the quote, it says, further, said transaction has to be propagated to the node's peers which multiplies the network's bandwidth requirements for supporting more transactions. The more transactions, the more the network's processing CPU and storage disk requirements grow for each node. Because running a node yields no financial benefits, the incentive to run one disproportionately decreases the more costly it is. So this is another one of the major things that, just from like a basic economics and sort of feedback loop concept, is that it's multiplying the network's bandwidth. So for every individual transaction that you can increase the block size to handle, you're getting 2 to 3 times the bandwidth cost. So your marginal return is terrible. Like, in fact, it's not even scaling. It is literally negative scaling, because the cost, the CPU cost, the storage cost, and the bandwidth cost increase more than you get in transaction throughput. All of them. And then at the exact same time, when you're talking about the node being essentially a voluntary thing that you're just doing for yourself and has no financial incentive, you know, unless you're a miner, but that's a completely different situation. Just to validate and secure it for yourself so that you know you're on the honest Bitcoin and you know nobody can cheat you and say that you own Bitcoin, or that, you know, they can't fake the blockchain to you. They can't give you a fake time chain and tell you you're on a different Bitcoin network, because that's all there is. The incentive to run one will decrease massively if the costs keep multiplying, and not only like multiplying, but disproportionately to any potential benefit you get. Like, transaction fees are still low on the network at 1 megabyte. And I think a lot of that's because a lot of traffic has moved over to Lightning, and we're beginning to see this more and more. But it's just exciting to see something that could actually work, and is actually working. I mean, it's something I use all the time, every single day, literally every single day. And it's massive. If you haven't started to play around with Lightning or like checked it out, download the Phoenix wallet, Breeze wallet, Moon. These are all non-custodial, with, you know, various minor trade-offs with the service that runs the wallet, or the devs that built the wallet and the service that runs as the LSP, the node that you're connecting to. But they're all excellent non-custodial wallets. But probably the best thing that I think was just such a good indication of how crazy this thing can be, and how well it scales as it grows, that there is that feedback loop of greater success and bigger transactions and more reliability, is this quote. It says, to give a sense of the progress here, River Financial recently shared that its payment success rate is 98.7% at an average size of $46, which is astonishingly better than the earliest publicly available data it could find from 2018, where $5 transactions were failing 48% of the time. That is a huge leap. And it's also indicative of transactions going through because of more nodes. And I don't know, I think we've seen tons and tons of growth, but I still think we're in the slow stage of growth around Lightning. Like, I think the Arcane Lightning report that we read was, it goes 400% increase over the year. But I still think that's slow. I think we're going to get to a point where we're reaching into a curve where there's just massive adoption. And I think I don't think we have many like kind of UX things to work out for that to really catch. But you know, just as normal, I'm just super bullish on it. I thought this was a great little article kind of breaking down the potential measurement of like what its actual transaction capacity could be. Even though we can't really see, you know, what's going on. It's pretty amazing that we're reaching a point where comparing to Visa makes sense. And in the next couple of years, we might make Visa look like a sad, centralized alternative that has none of the benefits of Lightning and can't even come close to the capacity. And that's going to be an exciting time. This is how you scale a protocol. You know, every complex system, all of our protocols, it's like a fundamental rule, is you scale in layers. because it's the only thing that's sustainable. It's the only thing that can actually get you order of magnitude increases in something that explicitly needs order of magnitude increases. If we're talking about just like sort of doubling or adding 30% capacity to the base chain, we've done nothing. We have to be building this thing out in layers. Now, there's always a question of whether or not the Lightning layer or something else is the solution, but I don't know, we've reached a point, and I mean, as somebody who uses it every day, I don't know, I feel like it's pretty obvious that Lightning is it, and it's happening. Like, we're witnessing it. But, I don't know, I'll leave it up to being wrong. But it's not going to happen without layers. Like, it's fundamental. It's the core engineering problem of this entire system. And the only solution to the blockchain trilemma is the layered approach. There's a reason why the internet took this approach. And there's a great quote by John Postel, about exactly that. In fact, I'll leave that for the credit quotes. So we'll actually close this out. I've gone way too far. Thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, and to Fold for supporting this show and keeping the lights on here and letting me do this. It's an awesome thing, and I love reading about Bitcoin and reading to you guys. So thank you so much for joining me. I will catch you next time. And until then, take it easy, guys. We are screwing up in our design of internet protocols by violating the principle of layering. Specifically, we are trying to use TCP to do two things: serve as a host-level end-to-end protocol, and to serve as an internet packaging and routing protocol. These two things should be provided in a layered and modular way. I suggest that a new distinct internetwork protocol is needed, and that TCP be used strictly as a host-level end-to-end protocol. John Postel, 1977.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.